Ill-gotten gains was the economic theme on Capitol Hill today. The CEO of Wells Fargo in the congressional hot seat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 20th day of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Today, in the ever-changing category that we have of corporate CEOs having the worst possible day, John Stumpf, the chairman and CEO of Wells Fargo. Wells, as you might remember, is paying a $185 million fine for, among other things, opening new accounts for millions of its customers without said customers knowing anything about it. It was done, it seems, in pursuit of hefty bonuses for the bankers involved. Mr. Stumpf, as a result, spent a couple of long, painful hours in front of the Senate Banking Committee today hearing their thoughts about what Wells Fargo did. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, it has to be said here, is no friend at all of the big banks, had some very specific remedies in mind.
You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on, and you should be criminally investigated.
Wells and many other companies, it turns out, actually do have provisions for taking money back from employees. It's called a clawback, but as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, it is not used all that often.
Clawback is a pretty good word for it.
A clawback is just when you thought you got away, they come after you.
Stephen Davidoff Solomon is a professor at UC Berkeley School of Law.
You've been paid your compensation, you've cashed your bonus, and you do something wrong, and they come back and take your bonus away.
Historically, companies could only grab back bonuses if someone personally broke the law. Since the financial crisis, companies have added other reasons for clawing back money.
Failure to supervise, bad faith, negligent in your duties.
Hillary Sale is a professor of law at Washington University.
Most of the clawback policies currently in place leave a fair amount of discretion to the board of directors.
Part of Dodd-Frank actually requires publicly traded companies to have clawback clauses, but it is not in effect yet. Still, a lot of companies are already putting them on the books.
85% of the Fortune 100 companies have these policies in place.
But this does not mean that they're dusted off and used very often.
Rarely.
David Min is assistant professor at UC Irvine School of Law.
But then again, they're fairly new.
Also, clawing back money can quickly become a legal catfight. And Min says boards may be hesitant because they don't want to discourage risk-taking.
The type of pushing the boundaries behavior is actually conduct that boards may want to see a lot of because in most situations it may tend to maximize shareholder wealth until they get caught.
Then again, not clawing back money after a scandal can look really, really bad. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There's a thing going on right now in the American economy that is, well, it's kind of fascinating, actually. A transformational industry is being developed virtually at the same time as government regulations to shape that industry are being written. Today, the Obama administration released guidelines to get makers of self-driving cars to share more information about their safety systems proactively instead of letting them just hash it all out on their own. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more on that one.
Even wonky Washington is in awe of what's coming with driverless cars, like Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox.
There has never been a moment like this, a moment where we can build a culture of safety as a new transportation technology emerges.
The Department of Transportation wants to make its guidelines on driverless cars mandatory eventually. But for now, officials are giving manufacturers some federal standards to work with and asking them to share information about their successes and failures with safety and cybersecurity. Regulators are trying to be nimble and flexible in a way one might not associate with government.
Traditional regulations are going to take too long.
Bryant Walker-Smith is an expert on self-driving cars at the University of South Carolina. He says the DOT seems to be learning from past missteps. He says, for example, by the time regulators on the aviation side of things finished a lengthy rulemaking process on drones,
those rules were already out of date at the moment that they went into effect.
With driverless vehicles, the stakes are high for the government getting in at the ground level. Vasant Dhar at New York University's Center for Data Science says driverless technology could have a huge impact on society, not just by saving us time driving.
There's a huge drag on the economy around accidents.
Despite some recent crashes of semi-autonomous cars, Dhar says driverless vehicles could actually end up being safer than human drivers. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
All right, so I'll be honest with you. I can't decide whether to set up this next story with the fancy economic term, which is externality, or with the word that my 9-year-old would use, which is poop, cow poop, to be specific. Both is what I went with, I guess. California Governor Jerry Brown signed a new climate change bill into law yesterday, tackling what are known as short-lived climate pollutants. Methane gas is one of them, of which dairy farms are a big source, and of which California has many. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
When you work in the dairy industry, you spend a lot of time worrying about the stuff that comes out of cows. Yeah, I'm not talking milk.
Manure management is our number one daily fight.
Anya Radabaugh is CEO of Western United Dairymen.
If you're not diligent in your manure management, it's going to reflect in the quality of your milk.
It used to be the dairy industry just needed to focus on milk, but now they need to focus on methane. California's new law requires reductions of 40% from dairies by 2024. Methane leaks out of manure, billows out in belches. Wait, do cows burp a lot?
Really?
Yeah, they do. Thanks, YouTube. UC Davis scientist Frank Mittlerner says even more methane comes from cow burps and flatulence than from manure. But for now, farmers just have to tackle manure. I mean, how would you collect a cow's gas?
It is a decision that has a lot to do with what's achievable and what can be sold to those that will be regulated.
Manure can be corralled. Methane from that can be collected by machines called digesters and burned for electricity. But there are only a handful of those in California right now.
We don't have the technology infrastructure right now. We don't have a network of vendors that can put out 500-600 digesters in a hurry.
Even if we did, they're not cheap. Millions of dollars apiece. Still, the industry does have about 7 years to figure it out. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The externality on Wall Street today was the Federal Reserve. News of their interest rate decision comes tomorrow. In the meanwhile, Bupkis will have the details when we do the numbers. The city council in Nashville, Tennessee, is going to be taking up as many as 6 separate ordinances in the next couple of weeks dealing with Airbnb and the whole concept of short-term rentals because, yes, of course, money. Short-term rentals are changing the way people invest in property because the trend is moving away from sharing the occasional spare room toward earning serious money doing it. In Nashville, some of the criticism is directed at an old apartment complex that has now been converted into nothing but short-term units. WPLN's Tony Gonzalez has more.
In a few ways, the McMillan Court looks like a vintage motel. It's 2 stories tall, in the shape of a horseshoe, and all 16 units have their own doors to the outside. The kicker is the neon sign, blue and yellow, that even says no vacancy. But that's kind of beside the point now. Since these are new short-term rentals, there's no front desk to even inquire about a room. Guests like Luke Graham book online.
I'm from London, England, and I'm here to do a video shoot in Nashville. And I'm staying here at the McMillan Court for 4 days.
He says it ticked all the boxes for location, cost, and simplicity. Instead of check-in, he was emailed the keypad codes for the front gate and for his room.
Yeah, but main thing, budget and ease of booking and everything else. It was dramatically cheaper than anywhere else.
In downtown Nashville, hotel rooms can run as high as $550, whereas Airbnbs and VRBOs tend to run in the $200 to $300 range. But what's really caught the community's attention about McMillan Court is that it has flipped into short-term rentals. In a past life, it was called the Phoenix Apartments, and it was surrounded by razor wire. It burned once and was condemned for a while before bouncing back. Still, its removal from the long-term rental market is an outcome that housing advocates like Grace Renshaw worry about. She told the city council recently that Nashville has lost about 3,000 residential units in the last year and a half by allowing short-term rentals. So, she says,
it shouldn't come as a big surprise to any of you that affordable housing suddenly becomes a much bigger problem in Nashville.
Her sentiment echoes nationwide. Tom Slee has analyzed Airbnb data for dozens of cities.
The whole building that you're talking about, it is at the extreme, obviously, but certainly not unheard of. That changes the character of a neighborhood, and it certainly raises prices for people who are trying to get by and live there.
Slee finds that in many places, nearly half the short-term rentals are run by investors with multiple listings, and they're concentrated in desirable neighborhoods. In some parts of San Francisco, 20 to 30% of rentals are now short-term. This has officials from the West Coast to New York City considering new limits. Yet, it's easy to see why a property owner might be interested.
I mean, these are all book dates. That's for this month.
That's Clay Llewellyn, the property manager at McMillan Court in Nashville. He's showing off his bookings calendar, with most dates marked, some through January. He says one unit can bring in $4,000 in a month instead of, say, $1,200 in rent. Now, the developers have had to put some money into these apartments.
Structurally, everything was fine, but, you know, it was showing the years of use.
The roof was replaced, along with flooring, cabinets, toilets, and all of the bathtubs. Llewellyn says this part of Nashville needs rooms like these, that feel like a temporary home. He points to hospitals nearby and says families with loved ones being cared for there often rent the space.
They can, you know, come in and wash clothes. They can do whatever they've got to do. There's basically not anything in this apartment that you could probably, or I keep calling them apartments, in the vacation rentals that you could need that's not necessarily provided for you.
Whatever their reasons, people are filling the rooms. And that's proof enough for him of the demand for short-term rentals and the business potential. In Nashville, I'm Tony Gonzalez for Marketplace.
Ticking through the show so far, we have done A Big Bank in Trouble, driverless cars, dairy cows, housing as well. So let's take a second here then for our series about how things feel to people in their daily lives. It's called My Economy, and today's dispatch comes to us from Columbus, Ohio.
My name's Dave Pardoe, and my economy feels slow and stagnant. There has been quite a few years where there's no pay raises, and you just feel like you're not going anywhere. I can remember back in high school thinking, oh, I'm going to do better than my parents. And I went to college. I was the first one in college. You know, I chose to study art. You know, I loved everything I did in college. It was a great time. But when you come out with an art degree, it's almost impossible to find a great paying job. I found lots of jobs, but, you know, they're all pretty low wage jobs. Got out of the college, went to get my master's, and assumed that wages would go up and that I would achieve kind of the American dream, which, you know, I've done a lot of that, but it's not to the point where I feel comfortable. I have an 11-year-old son. I feel like we have to push him into an area of study that will actually be less creative and will make a better income in the future. I followed my dreams when I went to college, and I don't think that's exactly possible for him. Although that's probably what he'll do. He's a very creative person.
That was Dave Pardoe. We got him in Columbus, Ohio, where he works at a museum. We would love to have you take a minute to share the story of your economy with us. You can do it at marketplace.org. Coming up,
we're at a point where more meals are taken out of the home than cooked in the home.
Wasn't always that way, though. First, let's do the numbers. Flat, flat, flatty McFlat flat. The Dow Industrials up just 9 points, finished at 18,129. The NASDAQ up 6 points, a 10%, 5241. The S&P 500 up less than a point, 2139. As we were talking about, Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf was on the receiving end on Capitol Hill today. Bank shares still went up, though. Because capitalism, 1.2%. Also not a good day to be SeaWorld. The water park operator said it's going to cut its dividend in half in October and then stop paying them all together to raise cash for buybacks. Shares sank as a result, down almost 4.5%. Bond prices were up just a touch ahead of the Fed meeting tomorrow. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There was a report out the other day by a completely reputable Wall Street firm saying the cannabis industry in this country could be worth $50 billion over the next 10 years. And the marijuana industry seems to be picking up speed going into November when 9 states will consider pot-related ballot measures. The big one is California, where a yes vote would make pot legal for recreational use here. Quite the tipping point, actually, considering the state's economy is the 6th biggest in the world. Jeff Tyler visited a cannabis business expo in Los Angeles not too long ago to follow the money.
At the convention center, if there was any smell in the air, it was the scent of money.
It's just a fascinating time and place to be. It's like being in the gold rush.
Al Vax came from San Francisco looking for business opportunities for himself and his partners.
And do you mind if I ask how much money are you guys talking about investing?
About initially like $100,000, you know, to begin with.
$100,000 is a drop in the bucket compared to the kind of money pouring into the pot industry. Steve Gormley is CEO of Seventh Point, a private equity firm that invests in legal medical marijuana companies in California. So far, the firm has raised $10 million. Gormley says he and most of his investors don't consume the wacky tobacco.
I would concede that, like many Americans, I did some research in college. It's not something I do today.
He says straight-laced business types are lining up to invest before pot is completely legalized.
Imagine what it was like for Seagram's or Joe Kennedy or other entrepreneurs investing in the alcohol business 3 to 5 years before prohibition was repealed.
Investor enthusiasm is expected to gain momentum if California voters legalize recreational weed. Brendan Kennedy is CEO at Privateer Holdings, a Seattle-based private equity holding company that owns and operates marijuana-related companies.
I think a lot of people on Wall Street, a lot of professional investors, will wake up on November 9th in a panic, realizing that they are 2 years behind in terms of understanding the industry and how to invest in it.
Privateer has invested in a Bob Marley brand of pot and a kind of cannabis encyclopedia called Leafly.
Hey there, friends. Regina here with Leafly's Cannabis 101. Today's question is, what's the difference between indicas, sativas, and hybrids?
So far, Privateer has raised more than $100 million. A good chunk of that came from Founders Fund, which is backed by billionaire PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel.
That investment gave other smart investors permission to explore investment opportunities.
Mainstream corporations are already investing. Scotts Miracle-Gro has been buying companies that support marijuana farmers, such as lighting and hydroponic stores, through its subsidiary, Hawthorne Gardening. The company declined an interview request, but its CEO has said publicly that the company plans to invest about $500 million in the industry. Along with their big money, the corporate players bring a style that's radically different from the counterculture pioneers. His extravagant parties have made something of a legend out of Michael Stromatis, who is known as Big Mike.
We are at Big Mike's Marijuana Mansion in West Hollywood.
Big Mike is one of the cannabis industry's most successful businessmen. He's the CEO of Advanced Nutrients, a marijuana fertilizer that he says has $90 million in annual sales. He recognizes that corporate and private equity money is inevitable and may even be good for the industry. But Big Mike expects that progress will come at the expense of the early risk takers.
It's almost like you invented something and you're holding it in your hand and some big bully comes along and takes it out of your hand and goes, "Thank you very much for all your hard work."
He says many of the industry's original entrepreneurs don't have the skills to compete.
The little store owner, the hydroponic store owner, is going to be put out of business by national chains. It just is. Either that or you get your game together and you start having the business practices and doing it the same way that the big boys do.
Same thing applies to new investors expecting to get rich quick.
Do you mind?
Back at the expo, I spoke with Tom Adams, principal analyst at BDS Analytics.
The idea that this is just going to be easy money is just dead wrong.
Adams says competition has had a significant impact on pot prices.
We're already seeing in Colorado the prices on pounds plummeting, and the other legal states, same thing. The margins are going to get squeezed in a big way in this business.
Investors lured by gold rush fever could see their dreams of a pot payday go up in smoke. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Next time you're out to eat, at a proper restaurant, mind you, fast food does not count. But the next time you're out, take just a minute or two and think about the very idea of restaurants in this country. Because once upon a time, they were kind of a revolutionary idea. 10 Restaurants That Changed America is the latest book from Yale historian Paul Friedman. Paul, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me here.
It's worth a mention here at the beginning that we didn't always have restaurants in this country. It's not like you could always go down to the corner of whatever village you lived in and stop in for, you know, a full customer service oriented meal.
That's right. You could always go down to some place that would give you some kind of takeout,
right,
or a tavern that had some food. But a place where you dined in a nice atmosphere with the people you came in with, where you had a choice of what to order from a menu, and where you could go at different times. That's only a couple hundred years old.
And it gets us to New York City in the 1830s-ish, Delmonico's, what you call America's first restaurant. How come?
Right. It's America's first real restaurant in the sense of presenting a gracious atmosphere, fine French cuisine, but also really more American cuisine than they let on. The menu was in French, but a lot of the dishes were pretty local. Nice service, and where the restaurant is what we would call a destination, not just a convenience.
They actually, they were doing farm to table. I mean, partly, I guess, because they had to, but partly also because it was about good ingredients and freshness and all of that stuff.
They went beyond what they absolutely had to do. They didn't like the produce in the market, and they bought a farm in then rural Williamsburg, Brooklyn, 200 acres, and raise their own crops.
Why does it eventually fade away and become part of history?
The simple answer is prohibition. Prohibition, and when it was passed in 1919, killed restaurants that mostly, as is the case now, depended on the profit from wine and alcohol. The more complicated explanation is they finally started to have competition in the 1890s. Places that were as expensive as swank and maybe a little bit more fun had a more kind of risque atmosphere.
I'm going to skip around a little bit. You talk about Schraft's in here. You talk about a soul food restaurant up in Harlem. And you also have only one chain restaurant in here. It was not, to my very great surprise, McDonald's. It's Howard Johnson's.
Right. McDonald's is impossible to imagine without Howard Johnson's, as are all fast food restaurants, because Howard Johnson's invented a couple of important concepts in the 20s and 30s. Roadside dining, dining that depends on cars and drivers. Mm-hmm. They developed franchising. Food that has a predictable quality. And now in our era of artisanal we don't see how important that is. But that predictability that McDonald's traded on, they pioneered.
All right, so let's jump forward a couple of decades and a couple of chapters in this book to the last entry, Chez Panisse and Alice Waters in Berkeley, California. Why is she in this book?
Well, it began as a French restaurant in 1971. By the mid-1980s, it had changed to something more American, maybe a little more Mediterranean, lighter, and more concerned with the immediate locality, seasons, and sustainability. It is a thing in itself that has influenced almost all new, relatively nice restaurants all over the country.
Well, so you leave off with Chez Panisse in plus or minus 1980, discovering sort of the identity that it has now. So where are we today with this idea of restauranting in America and American cuisine?
Well, for starters, we're at a point where more meals are taken out of the home than cooked in the home. But the basic tendency in America is the rediscovery of things that we allowed to become almost extinct. Small farms, small batches, artisanally made products, you know, strawberries that are in season rather than from Watsonville, California. Sure. That's the dominant tendency now from Brooklyn to Berkeley.
Paul Friedman teaches history at Yale. His most recent book is called 10 Restaurants That Changed America. Paul, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
We've got an excerpt of Paul Friedman's book. It's at our website, which is marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the line of the day today comes via BuzzFeed. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, when told of the Angelina Jolie Brad Pitt divorce news, said this, quote, "Just when you think it couldn't get any worse, it did." Also, though, and in all seriousness, can you imagine the angst in Hollywood over who made which deal with which of them, or, God forbid, both of them? Two words about Wall Street today, Janet and Yellen. The Fed is meeting today and tomorrow. Interest rates tomorrow. We'll let you know what they said. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.